As always, we are going to begin our lesson. We are in the book of Esther, chapter 1. And we have our Esther scepter.
I had nothing to do with the Esther scepter.
Screaming is all
that. I know.
Other than we had it in our house.
When Scooby gets this, this is all we're going to hear. So, I apologize for the distraction, but I'm really excited. All right. So, last week we kind of talked about the promise that Mordecai was holding on to, and that was the covenant that God had made between he and Abraham. And we saw that that kind of extended to all the nations, and that even extended even into us. And then we had the chain sitting across the table, and we said that chain represents God's plan, and we are just little pieces of fabric in each link along the way, right? And we claimed that all things work together for good to those who love God. Those are the things that we did last week. So today, we begin actually our study in the book of Esther. So as we begin this, we are introduced to the king, and that's who we're going to concentrate on this evening. So, yes, Esther chapter 1, we'll read verses 1 through 4, and I'll begin. It says, "This is what happened during the time of Xerxes." Some of your books may say Ahasuerus. "The Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. At the time of King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne, at this time, King Xerxes was reigning from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa," or some of your books will say Shushan, okay? "And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media, and the princes and the nobles of the provinces were all present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor of his glory and majesty." And we're going to stop right there so I can kind of give a little bit of an introduction here. Another one, right? So King Xerxes, King Ahasuerus, to kind of put this in perspective, we have taught through the book of Nehemiah. We talked a little bit about Daniel. And so names that came out of those, we saw in the book of Nehemiah, we had King Artaxerxes. That is this Xerxes' son. Okay? So that puts the book of Esther, this story, this history lesson of how this feast came about. The book of Esther is technically before the book of Nehemiah. And in fact, we see that in the first part of the book of Ezra, Ezra is writing to King Darius, or Darius, depending on who you listen to and how you grew up. And so we saw King Darius, remember Daniel in the lion's den? That was King Darius. King Darius is mentioned in the book of Ezra. And so we have King Darius, King Xerxes, and King Artaxerxes. To put them in perspective, Darius of Daniel in the lion's den is the father of this king, Ahasuerus, Xerxes, and Artaxerxes in the book of Nehemiah and further into the book of Ezra, who let the Jerusalem temple be built and the walls of Jerusalem be built from Nehemiah. That is this Xerxes' son. Okay? Hopefully that's not too confusing, but that kind of puts you in the perspective of where this falls, right? Everybody has weird names.
So it's the son.
This King Xerxes, Ahasuerus, is the son of King Darius.
Right. So his grandson is
Artaxerxes.
Okay.
Darius' grandson is Artaxerxes.
Okay.
All right. So we have this picture. This is who we are. He gives a party for 180 days in his third reign. Can you imagine?
6 months.
6 months party. I cannot.
Sounds like a college dream.
Right? I mean, good night. What do you do for 6 months? So who was at the party? Do you remember? Who did we read about who was at the party?
Officials and servants.
So officials, servants, nobles, princes.
Heads of armies.
Heads of armies, yeah. So just kind of keeping things, welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
Keeping everything back in perspective. We talked about King Xerxes was this warrior who went to Greece. And we're going to see that towards the end of this chapter. There's a gap between chapter 1 and chapter 2. And this six-month party, per se, was King Xerxes actually planning and bringing all of his noblemen around and his warriors to say, hey, we're going to go battle in Greece, and this is what we're going to go do. Okay? So that's what this six-month party was for. Shushan is the winter palace. We saw that when we were looking at King Darius and Daniel. He was down in Shushan at the time as well. This is the same location that Nebuchadnezzar was in Babylon, in Shushan, in the winter palace. A lot of things happened down here in this area. This citadel is right above, right kind of in the apex of the Persian Gulf. Right here's the Persian Gulf, and just about 10 miles north of that was this little city of Shushan. All right, so passing the Esther scepter to you, please read verses 5 through 8.
And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars. And the couches were of gold and silver on the mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. How many verses?
8 through 8, please.
And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure.
Okay. So describe for me, what is this? What's happening now? So we've had a six-month party break, and now for the next 7 days, we have another one. But this one's a real party, right?
This is just for the people inside the citadel.
Correct. Everyone who did the serving for the last 6 months, right, he's throwing them a party now. And he said, what was his, hey, drink as much as you want, no limits. Anybody ever done that? I don't answer that question. Don't answer that question. What happens when you do something without limits? Let's ask that question.
People go overboard. They cross boundaries. They do things stupidly that they shouldn't.
Yeah. We're all guilty of that, right?
Yeah.
My commentary says that guests could drink as much or as little as they please. This differs from the usual Persian custom by which people at a banquet were required to drink each time the king raised his cup.
So they could pretty much do whatever they wanted and not have to look at the king.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. It's a drinking
game. You have to think how hard that would be, though. I mean, that's interesting that he does that. I'm like, okay, I don't know that I'm going to be thirsty every time somebody else is going to, you know, raise their glass.
I'd be the one like, hey.
Everybody's waving. So this area that this party is taking place in, it what is it?
The
What is the area in which this party is taking place?
The court of the garden of the king's palace.
Okay.
So it's like probably like his private court of some sort?
Yes, this is the king's private garden. Now, what this was called was the hanging gardens. Not because they hung people, but because it was a 400 foot by 400 foot by 80 foot tall garden. The 80 feet, they were tiered. And in each one of the commentaries I read, they all made a very interesting point to point out that it was all specially irrigated, and the irrigation system that they used for ancient times, they didn't have a hose to plug into the, you know, to get it all up there. It was all state-of-the-art irrigation from 80 feet all the way down, and they had flowers and shrubs, and I mean, it was just this opulent beauty all around. That's what we're talking about. And so they're in the middle of this court where all of these gardens hang above them, and all of the beauty and just the, I would call it splendor. We have mother of pearl described here. We have marble. We have cloth that is white, blue, and purple, turquoise, marble columns. Yeah, so what, yeah, let's talk about the silver and gold. You've got your benches that are gold. And alabaster. Have you ever seen that? It's like, I've seen pictures on TV, right? I've never seen it in real life. It's like a clear, right? It's almost iridescent, clear stone. Let's talk about the drinking glasses. What did it say about those?
Golden vessels, various kinds.
Yeah.
That's what mine says.
Yeah, golden vessels, various kinds. Anyone else have a different word?
I was just saying they didn't match.
They didn't match.
They're each their own work of art.
Yes. Imagine, I mean, we don't know how many people that he's feeding here, but I think we could safely say there was well over 100, wouldn't you think? I think that's a conservative number, personally, for all the people that helped serve for the last 6 months. Not one of those glasses matched.
This is many designs.
Yeah, many designs.
Well, is it my understanding that that party was just for the men, and then Queen Vashti had her own,
she
the
had her
one for the
right.
women.
Yeah, we're getting
so
ready.
So this
yeah.
was just for the men.
Just for the men.
That's pretty fancy for just men.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty fancy. Esther chapter 1. So let's go ahead and read verses 9 through 11, please. No, wait a minute. Before we get started, how would you describe this setting?
He's trying to impress people.
Yeah.
And he is oppressing people because he's showing off all he's got.
Yeah, he just threw a party for 6 months, and the food didn't run out.
He displayed his riches.
Yeah.
Like it says before.
The wine didn't run out.
What kind of food was it? I mean, kind of feel like he's a little generous too, because now he's doing a party for all the people who served in his first party.
Yep.
Have you guys? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. I'm just going.
I was gonna say, have you guys ever seen the Hunger Games, where
yeah.
like they show like
I
the
felt
parties,
full asleep in it.
Where it's like just obnoxiously just rich and snobby people just for no reason whatsoever. I don't know. That's just what I think of in my mind. Like an obnoxious amount of just,
okay,
have this going on just because.
Yeah. So would you say
all the nobles?
Yeah. King Xerxes is a pretty big deal, right? I mean, you don't get more powerful than where he's at this point in his life, right?
If you were invited to the party, it was an honor to go.
It was definitely an honor to go. All right.
I didn't see that, but did you see the table that was set for King Charles and Trump?
I did not.
That was, yeah.
Just obnoxiously.
Yes. It was
yes.
A wonderful
snobby.
Yeah. Flowers.
It was decked out like
on the table.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was. Wow.
Yeah.
Very extravagant.
Yeah. They served him a wine.
A long table.
1945 to honor his mother and some kind of whiskey that was equally old. He didn't touch it, but they commented on that. But just that's how lavish it was there.
Trump doesn't
drink?
No.
Yeah. He
does it. Wow. Opulent. That's it.
Yeah,
a very luxurious opulence in both scenarios, right? That's kind of what we're looking at. All right. So verses 9 through 11, please.
Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women of the king Ahasuerus' palace. And on the seventh day, when the king was feeling good from the wine, I don't know how to pronounce all these names.
You don't have to read the names.
It said seven of them, eunuchs, who personally served him, to bring Queen Vashti before him with her royal crown. He wanted to show off her beauty to the people and officials because she was very beautiful.
Okay. So give me a description of what's happening here.
It's one to show her off.
It's one to show her off.
Display her beauty to the people. Mm-hmm. Like, look what else I have.
Yeah. Yeah, hey, I've got something else. So in a couple of the commentaries that I read, and I can cite them, there's Ken Hughes. It's the commentary on Esther, Nehemiah, and Ezra. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. That commentary, I have a Zondervan illustrated commentary, and two other guys that I listen to a lot, all made reference to rabbinic, so text written by old rabbis, historically referenced that this idea that she was to come in her crown meant that she was supposed to wear her crown and nothing else. Now, today in that culture, and even back then in that culture, it was not appropriate for a woman to go without wearing a veil on her face, to cover her face, let alone just her clothes, right? So now the king has asked her to step out of the cultural norm to show up not only in her crown, not only without her veil, but potentially without any clothes, with your crown on. That's what I want. Right. Because he's trying to show just how
beautiful she is.
Yeah, and how powerful he is that he can command a woman to do such a thing. All right, so let's go through verses 13 through 14. Oh, I'm sorry, 12 through 14.
But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king, so to speak, before all who knew law and justice and were close to him, Karshina, Sethar, Amantha, Tarshish, Marys, Marcina, Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and set in first place in the kingdom.
Okay, before we go into what his question is, Queen Vashti said, no, I'm not coming, right? So what's his first reaction? Now remember, as this story is being told, we're still in this 7 days of stupor that he's in. What is his solution to this?
He hasn't said a solution.
Yeah, that's
no, he hasn't. But what's he done? He's gathered all these all the wise guys, right? All the smart guys.
She just basically put him down.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Because it's like.
Well, and he's already put on fury and anger, so he's already, besides the fact he's drunk, heightened that with anger and fury, which is fed by the drunkenness, and now he's going to get all these this court of folks in front of him because he's embarrassed and, you know, feeling put down and all of this.
Where to take
revenge. He's just like, okay, I'm sure in his mind he's like, okay, now I got to do something.
I can't.
Yeah, I'm the king. I've got to. Yeah.
And she's also being called out, though, in verse 9, because she also gave a banquet for the women in the palace. So she's being called away from what she's doing.
Yeah.
To be called out in front of all her people, too, that she's having a banquet with.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
So she's putting her on the spot.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm going to show him. And then he pretty much shows her that he's king and she's queen.
Right.
Or not so much.
Yeah. I like the idea that you guys pointed out that there's some disobedience here, but there's also some embarrassment on King Xerxes' side, right? Makes our decision-making sometimes a little bit convoluted, doesn't it? When we get embarrassed, sometimes we overreact. So let's read verse 15. What is the question here? Verse 15.
He said, according to the law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti? Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus, which was conveyed by the eunuchs.
Okay.
Ahasuerus. Xerxes.
Yes.
In some translation.
So in the NIV, he calls him King Xerxes. Ahasuerus. In the King James, New King James, Ahasuerus.
Xerxes.
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 Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's the question that he's asking?
What would law allow me to do to her?
He's really furious right now.
He's very angry, isn't he? Okay. So let's keep on going then. Verse 16 through 18. And this gentleman's name is Memucan, or Memucan.
16 to 18?
16 to 18, please.
Memucan said, in the presence of the kings and his officials, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but all the officials and the people who are in every one of the king Ashurus's provinces. For the queen's actions will become public knowledge to all the women and cause them to despise their husbands and say, King Ashurus ordered Queen Vashti brought, King Ashurus ordered Queen Vashti brought before him, but she did not come. Before this day is over, the noble women of Persia and Media who hear about the queen's act will say the same thing to all the king's officials, resulting in more contempt and fury.
Okay. So, what's Memucan's argument?
If she gets away with it, so will all the other women.
Mm-hmm. So, what's he afraid of?
Anarchy.
Sorry. Yeah. Well, that's women's lib. Women can't have voice. Some things never change.
She started a revolution.
Yes. Right. That's exactly true.
That was the fear.
That was the fear. Yeah. She's going to start a revolution, and all of a sudden, yeah. We can't have that.
How many people knew that he made this request? Like, was it obvious? Like, he's like, I'm going to bring out the queen, or was he like, go get the queen? Was he being outward, or was he just like kind of to himself, and then he's angered, and then now he's making it seem like she did this action to incite?
So that's a good question. We don't really know from the text, but we can kind of infer this idea, and I think it was more of an outward thing. Hey! Tell the queen to get over here and just wear a crown. I got something for you to see. She's beautiful.
Have you ever
heard
anybody who's drunk to be quiet?
I was going to say, there's no quiet drunks. Yeah. And listening, right.
Everyone's watching, everyone's listening. He has the Esther scepter in his hand, right? I mean, he's the one that everyone's going to listen to when he opens up his mouth, right? He's got the scepter. And he
sent the eunuchs, the seven eunuchs or whatever, to go and get her. So now they're accountable to him. So
yeah, and so...
And what's really going on when all these guys are going to... What are you guys doing? Oh, I'm going to get the queen.
Yeah, and so let's describe that moment for a minute. Why does it take seven to do that?
She was going to go fight.
Well, not necessarily. Right. So a lot of the text and a lot of the commentary lends to this. Because she's a queen, they're going to not make her walk in, of course. They're going to carry her in on what's called a litter, or basically a bed on poles that she sits on, and they carry him on her shoulders. So you got three guys and one out there proclaiming, "Here comes the queen! Make way! Here comes the queen!" Right? So this is a big production for her to come into this group of men. And so you know that the bed or the litter or the the cart, whatever you want to call it, the bed was walked out in front of many because it's a procession. Make way, make way. The king is called the queen, right? That's the idea that we have here. And so now he is embarrassed in front of everyone who works for him. He's throwing this party for everyone who's in the citadel, who spent 6 months throwing a party, helping throw this party that he made. And now all of these people are working for him. And now all of a sudden she says, "No, I'm not coming."
But also for the women that was having the party, that the queen had thrown for them. So it's the seven plus all of them plus everybody that's a queen of the king.
Correct. So now this bed comes into the women's palace, or Vashti's palace, and which is an extension off of the king's palace, right? It's her own place. And so this bed with seven guys come in and says, "Hey, king says, hop up here, put on your crown, and take the rest off, and let's go." And she, in front of all these ladies, says, "You can take the bed right back to the king. I'm not coming."
Good.
Exactly, right? No condemnation here, right? But think about that. I mean, we know, because if we've read ahead, we know that Esther is afraid to go into the king uninvited because she could die, right? Refusing a man who is this opulent, who is this quote unquote powerful, who reigns over 100. So this idea of India to Kush. Kush is another name for Ethiopia. So India, remember our little crude map here. India, then you've got Iraq, Iran, all of the Palestine, Turkey, all the way up into just touching into the book of Philippians, if you will, Philippi on the edge of Greece, Macedonia, and then you have all the way over to Egypt, into Ethiopia, and further down the Nile. That's all of, and Saudi Arabia, right? All of that is his territory. A third or half of the known world at that point in time. Powerful man. And so now he's upset. So let's find out what the new law is, verses 19 through 20.
If it meets the king's approval, he should personally issue a royal decree. Let it be recorded in the laws of Persia and Media so that it cannot be revoked. Vashti is not to enter King
Xerxes.
Xerxes, thank you. Presence and her royal position is to be given to another woman who is more worthy than she. The decree the king issues will be heard throughout the vast kingdom, so all women will honor their husbands from the greatest to the least.
Okay. So what is the new rule, the new law?
She's done. Let's find someone else.
Yeah. And what is the purpose of this law? Did you catch that?
So that all men know that if they call her wives, that they should come.
Well, and another thing, he's got all these wise men and all this council, all these princes here, which know women. It's like, okay, well, you guys can help me find somebody.
Yeah.
It's a perfect place. He was probably done with her anyway.
So they didn't kill her, they just banished her, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it depends. There is argument about this.
Okay.
So in... There is history that says that the queen can no longer come in front of the king. That can mean banishment. It could also mean that she was dispatched. Right?
Most
killed.
Likely he probably would have, but unless he sold her to somebody else.
Right. And so there is not conclusive evidence. And I would say... I would say it this way. I think the text is written this way on purpose, because last week we made this point. I didn't really make it too much today, and that is the book of Esther is a story told to children on why we have the Feast of Purim. Okay? The Feast of Purim is still celebrated today. It's celebrated in our month of March. It's their 12th month. Passover is the very next month. So they celebrate God rescuing the Jews through this. This is what this feast is all about. So this is what this story is all about, this how this Feast of Purim came about. And then the very next month we go into the resurrection or Passover, right? God's rescue again. God rescued the Jews here. God rescued the Jews here differently. So this is a story. And it's written after the fact, not in the time, right? It's well after the fact that this story is written. And so there are pieces of the story that we don't know that are glossed over so that they can tell a story to their children and keep it as clean as possible, because to this day, little girls dress up like Esther and the boys dress up as the villain, Haman, and they make these little biscuits called something, these little cookies, and they're in the shape of an ear for Haman's ear, because King Xerxes had, you know, he had, Haman had the king's ear, right? He was always his right-hand man. So that's the kind of the picture. And so this story is retold through that Feast of Purim. So, whether she was banished or killed, I truly don't know. I know that she was never to come before the king again.
So March was the 12th month? Is that what you're saying?
Their, yes, in their calendar, yes, March is the 12th month. Okay. And let me be very clear, the Jewish calendar goes this way. It tips back and forth, because sometimes, every so many years, they add another month. So they have 13 months. And that's to take care of leap day. Well, we do leap day every 4 years. They do every 7 or so years, they add another month.
A whole month.
A whole month.
So it'll be April then, one whole month?
Sometimes. But it all depends on where you are in the calendar, right? I mean, that's kind of the way that works.
Doesn't the king have a bunch of wives? Like, he has a whole house of wives.
Yes, but this was, let me say it this way, because this is what we're setting the stage for. She had her own palace.
Right.
Her own
home. She was like
home.
The chief wife.
She was the chief wife. She was the queen.
The main wife over all the other wives.
Yes.
Because my commentary says she lost that privileged position as the chief wife.
Yes. And then was never to come before the king again.
Yeah. Most likely banished, but
yeah.
Could have been killed.
And we also know that she had a son. It's our understanding that Artaxerxes was her son. And so that's again in those commentaries. I didn't do the genealogy. I don't know. I'm okay with not knowing. I don't need to know. All right, so verse 21 through 22. Let's find out what the actual edict from the wise men, from the wise king was.
The king and his counselors approved the proposal, and he followed
Memucan's
advice. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to each province in its own script, into each ethnic group in its own language, that every man should be master of his own house and speak in the language of his own.
Okay. So what happened here?
So basically everybody agreed with it, with what the king said.
So is he giving everybody permission to like make their own law in their own house? They can do whatever they want? You're the boss in your own house?
Yeah. Yeah, men, Queen Vashti lost her privilege of being my queen, and I expect you to hold your house the same. You are the head of your home. Now, biblically, that's something sound, right? Where did he take it, though? He took it to the left, to an extreme, not a left, but an extreme. He took a turn off the street, right? The idea here is that he's making a rule that everyone, all the men, at least, can come around and say, yeah, I'm the head of my house, and she does what I say. His actual statement is, you are the head of your house, you have no say, right? That's what's happening here. And so he makes this edict. She leaves the house. She's no longer supposed to be there. That's where we end chapter one.
So he's trying to gain back his credibility, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm the boss.
Yeah.
And that's where you get all these honor killings and abuse and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even with that, I want to think, so what, like what you stated earlier, it's not biblical, because like the best representation we have of like a husband loving his wife is how like God talks about how, you know, he's... Is it Israel his bride, you know, and like that, like, you know, that's the best representation we have of like, you know, God being the head of like, you know, household and stuff. Like,
right.
You know.
So when I say it's biblical, right?
I can read something.
Go ahead.
Ephesians 5, if you go to verse 22, there's a few different places to find this in Peter or Colossians. It says, wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, and Christ also the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be subject, ought to be to their husbands and everything.
Yeah.
And then it talks about husbands.
Right. And the real challenge in all of that is actually when it begins talking about the husband, because we are to create an environment where our wives want to come alongside of us, right? It's not a servant type of role, which is what King Xerxes has created and instituted. It's this come alongside and the work together, right? Work together to become a couple that is amazing at what they do together in front of God, right?
So to me, like, it's God being revealed in scriptures that's not talked about necessarily, because God's all over this, but when we don't see him, he's still there, right?
Right.
We talked about that.
We talked about that last week.
And, well, I wasn't here exactly for last week, but right. We've talked about it many times.
Yeah, we have.
And it's God fulfilling later the things that he, you know, his promises and his structure.
Good.
Even though that we don't necessarily see it at this point in the
right. So let's continue, and we're only going to read verse 1 at this moment. Read verse 1 of chapter 2.
All right. After these things, when the anger of King Xerxes had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her.
So what's going on?
Remorse.
Search for a new queen.
Yeah. Pretty soon. Search for.
Let's go back and add one more chance.
Go ahead.
Look back at the end of the chapter.
Yes. You can tell
me. What is it? Yeah, look at verse 22. It said he sent letters to all the royal provinces, to each province, that's not a script. Okay, so they're writing all of these letters to all of these different locations, all of their different languages. How much time that took?
Yeah.
Because one, the writing, two, delivery, follow through, and response back. That this is not something that, you know, in our day and age is done in a half a second. You know, this is something that would take months and not
years.
Into a year or so
yeah.
to do that. So a lot of time has gone by.
Yeah, let's say at least 6 months to a year has gone by just in the communication process, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And we're going to get to what happens here in just a minute, but let's then say, okay, in chapter 1, or chapter 2, verse 1, what do we see out of his behavior?
Some regret.
Remorse, anguish.
Right.
Anger. Right.
He misses her.
Subsided.
That's what mine says.
Yeah.
Never remember.
Yeah. So now all of a sudden he's having, oh man. And the only thing we haven't talked about really is this Medes and Persia law. We talked about it a little bit when we went through the book of Daniel. And in the book of Daniel, we found out that the laws of the Medes and Persians was, anybody remember?
Say it again, I'm sorry.
The law of the Medes and Persians is what?
When we read what you're saying?
In Daniel. It could not be revoked. So remember, in the book of Daniel, you had King Darius was persuaded to make a law to not pray to any other god, but to not pray to anyone but him. And the death, or the penalty would be thrown into the lion's den. That was specifically geared towards the king's right-hand man was Daniel, right? And the king, if you remember, once they caught him and Daniel said, yeah, I prayed to God. And he had this rule that he had to go be thrown in the lion's den. The king, if you recall, spent the entire day trying to find a loophole in the law of the Medes and the Persians. And the whole thing about the law of the Medes and the Persians was no one, not even the king, could revoke a law. Now, they could write something later, but they couldn't break that law. And there was no way to do that without losing their own life, right? So Daniel gets thrown in the lion's den. God closes the mouth of the lion. They come out. The lions haven't eaten for a long time. And King Darius says, hey, my smart guys, throw them in. And they're devoured before they even hit the floor, right? So that's what happened in that story. But the law of the Medes and the Persians can't be broken. So now he's got all this remorse. What has happened between chapter 1 and chapter 2? So we know that if we lead a little bit further down in chapter 2, that we are, in our next verse, we're going to start this one-year process, okay? Queen Esther meets the king after a whole year of, and we're going to see this next week, after a whole year of being prepared and groomed and cleaned and freshened up and smelling good and all the things. And then in the 7th year of the 10th month of King Xerxes' reign, he meets Esther. So we subtract 7 years and 10 months. We subtract a year. That's 6 years and 10 months. And where did we begin? Around the 3rd year of his reign, right? Was the first big party. Then there was another party. Then we had all this communication about this big law that Vashti's out. And she's not going to come back because I'm the boss of my house. And now, in between chapter 1 and chapter 2, King Xerxes takes hundreds of thousands of men is the estimate. But from all 127 provinces, he takes an army up through Turkey, crosses over into Macedonia, and comes down into Greece. And he has one of the largest battles in the ancient history, the Battle of Thermopylae. And we talked about that last week. We have the Battle of Thermopylae, which is King Leonidas of the Spartans and King Xerxes with his 1,000,000 men. And 300 men held off hundreds of thousands of men, we'll say a million, but that's the estimate. They held them off for a series of about 3 days that allowed the rest of the Grecian army to come down and prepare for a naval battle. The Spartans die in the Battle of Thermopylae, but they've held them off long enough that King Xerxes has to take his men around the mountain and come over here to Somalis. I said it wrong. I know I did. But anyway, another town. Xerxes conquers and takes Athens, but there's no one in Athens because everyone's down ready for the naval battle. And Xerxes is thwarted. He fails. His entire army, his entire naval group is destroyed, and he loses the battle in Greece, and he has to tuck tail and go all the way home with all of the rest of his army, having been opulent, powerful, rich, all the things that we just saw in chapter 1. And at the end of chapter 1, he's coming home defeated. He didn't conquer Greece.
He was humbled.
He was humbled. And now in chapter 2, verse 1, now he's depressed. Hey, I went out there to conquer the world. I'm not as big. I'm not as powerful as I thought I was. 300 men kicked my rear end all over the town. And I don't even have Vashti to come home to.
Poor baby.
Right?
He made his bed and he's got a lion.
And now the actions have consequences, right? So now he's realizing the actions of his consequences, or the consequences of his action. So let's finish our story that we're going to read tonight, and let's read verses 2 through 4, and then this will be the end of our story tonight.
My turn then. Then the king's attendants who served him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint overseers in all province of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, and says Susa to the harem. Into the custody of Hege, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given to them."
And verse 4?
Oh, verse 4. "Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti, and the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly."
Okay. So, what has his group of smart guys recommended this time?
That he's going to be able to pick and choose who he wants.
Yeah. And what do they do to do this?
Recruiters.
Yeah. Recruiters.
Yeah. And they're gathering up all these pretty young girls. Last week we said they're taking them from their homes. Right. It's a nice way to tell a story, but when we look at this in reality, these girls who are teenagers to their early 20s is what the estimate is. They're being taken.
And they're all virgins.
And now they're going to be given to the king. Next week, we're going to see what happens to each one of these through the eyes of Esther, right? Because we're introduced next week to Esther. So there's nothing really glamorous about this. There's nothing really pretty about this. But let me ask this question, and this is the question we're going to ask every single week that we go through this book, because we've spent 16 months going through the book of Proverbs and how we're to behave and how we're to act. And we talked last week about how all things work together because God has a plan. Let me ask you, they can't see it yet, can they?
No.
But what do we see God having done from chapter 1 to the first four verses of chapter 2? What has God done so far?
Created and opened up by his choice.
Okay.
Setting up the scene.
I feel like in a sense he's not really doing anything. He's kind of letting us fall on our face, or letting these, allowing us to wallow in the mud.
Humbled Xerxes. And also has shown him that no matter his desires of the flesh, they're always going to fail.
So my commentary says about the inner ordinance, it says, again, we see the exaggerated sense of power of the king contrasted with the fragile status of women. Beautiful young virgins were seen to exist merely to bring pleasure to the king. So even though that's, you know, a non-biblical view, God's using it for a good purpose that we'll see later. He's using the evil in our world and making good out of it. He's okay. Found that loop, right?
I can't see 2 and 3 what they say.
So it says, allow Xerxes to be humbled and to, I don't know if I spelled it right, but I'm going to say I did. Waller in the mud. And Waller is spelled W-A-L-L-E-R in my world.
That's fine.
I'm sure it's not, but we'll just go with it.
I think something else, that maybe not necessarily to this question, but just how destructive, like a king who's immature can be for the culture. Because to this point, it wasn't really, like, it's almost like this law is rewarding weak men to abuse their wives. And then not only that, is he's employing people to in all his areas to fulfill this role of finding these women. And then beyond there, he's saying, not only you're the prettiest in your thing, but not only you're pretty, you're not pretty enough, I'm going to give you these enhancements, and only then are you maybe acceptable to our king. Because he is the royalty, the popular guy. Everyone wants to be like the king. It's more than just the yes men who are surrounding him. There's just people who are, the king is doing this, therefore this is right. And like you said, I mean, without the context of like this law being, this is the law from now on now, it's just like, it's, he alone has shifted his culture into, or allowed, built a culture that allows for weak people to prosper, weak-minded people to prosper.
Yeah. So do you remember in the book of Proverbs chapter 31, verses 1 through 9, which was the challenge of the queen to Lemuel on how to behave as a king? Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. So look it up. Proverbs chapter 31, verses 1 through 9. And let's just contrast very quickly, like the next 5 minutes, and then we'll be done. Proverbs chapter 31, verses 1 through 9. As you skim through that, let's talk about what makes a good king, according to the queen who's writing to her son here, and contrast that.
The first one would be don't drink.
Don't drink.
Say yep.
The king should not drink, right? Why?
Lest they drink and forget the law.
Ding. Xerxes did that one. What else do
and
we see?
And pervert the justice.
And pervert the justice. And that's exactly what Xerxes has done, isn't it?
Well, then it even says, do not give strength to women nor your ways to that which destroys kings. Xerxes kind of set himself up by doing exactly what it doesn't say.
Exactly what it says not to do.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And even like the giving strength to women thing, it's not like he's giving strength to a woman who is evil. He himself is holding women, his view of women as being objects.
Yes.
That sin is holding, is warping his mind. It's not the woman doing that. It is Xerxes' view of women as being below him, which causes his rage, which causes him to then regurgitate his sin on others, and like it's a domino effect.
Yeah.
It also shows obedience to the law, because now he's got a law and you got to follow it, right?
Yeah.
But going back to your question, God knew that he had to allow this to happen so that ultimately the line of Jesus would be preserved, right? That
yeah.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, so when we look at the end of the of this book, we know that the children of Israel are saved because of Esther, right? So far, which I don't think in Esther's mind, she would have ever thought that this was part of a larger plan, right?
Yeah, if you're living right there in that moment, you don't know the end of the story, you're not going to, how do you see God in that?
Right.
They're not going to see what we're seeing. We see that one because we know the end of the story.
And
she even says in there, Esther even says in there that Mordecai is the one that raised her and showed her and guided her, basically. So, you know, he was her...
He's her uncle.
Her
father.
Bible, though, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
None of this would have happened without Mordecai, because he's the one who...
Just so happened to hear.
Well, yeah, he overheard what they were going to do to the king, and then the king wanted to honor him. If that hadn't happened, this story would all have been different.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to asking this question each and every week to see how all the things that God has done. We're going to list them each week. You know, these are the things that God has done. And that's the way I want to approach this book. Because I think it's an amazing story on when we look at Esther here in a couple of weeks, we'll see that it's been 12 years when she goes in front of the king. Right? 12 years. That's
before
a long time.
She gets to the king?
Before she approaches the king. It's in his 12th year that she approaches the king about
the
Jews.
Yeah, the Jews situation.
Oh, that long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this took a period of doing math quickly, 9 to 12 years. Yeah, 30 years. All right. So with that all food for thought, things to think about, each week we're going to ask this question, what is God doing? Let's pray, and I hope that this will be encouraging.
I'm so sorry.
You're okay. Dear Heavenly Father, Lord, we do love you. And again, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the story that you have laid out for us. Lord, you've given us a picture of a king that he breaks all the rules. Pray, Lord, that we would be able to talk about your providence, your love, your guiding light in our life, and how your plan isn't always our plan. And sometimes we go through some very difficult things in our life that are discouraging and disappointing and hard and unimaginable. And yet, Lord, you are always with us. Pray that you would encourage us this week. Give us a hope that you are here. You listen. You're there. You're always here. In Jesus' name. Amen.
Says the Bible is boring.